afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak. What I'm going to do today is just to simply try and give some context how we use environmental fate data in environmental risk assessments for GM crops. So nothing very profound on this slide, just a summary of the kinds of things that we look at. So we're asking questions about where will the protein be when the plant is being cultivated, how far will the protein spread, how long will it be there, how much of it will there be, these kinds of questions. And the processes and pathways that we look at, things like the production of the protein in the crop, the movement in tissue, so things like pollen movement, the movement between trophic levels, so herbivores feeding on the plant and then those herbivores being fed on by predators or parasitoids, the movement of the protein in soil and water, its persistence in the crop during cultivation and its spread outside cultivation in feral populations, and even gene flow to other crops and to uncultivated species. Now, of course, these are a means rather than ends. They're not the end of the assessment. What we're trying to do in ecological risk assessment is to estimate the seriousness and likelihood of any ecological harm due to the production of the transgenic proteins in the crops. And this activity can be viewed as an example of hypothetico-deductive logic of scientific discovery, which is really a pretentious way of saying it's trial and error, as Popper viewed scientific discovery, and various other things as well. He came up with this pathway for the production of objective knowledge, and what he says was that to do this logically, what we do is identify a problem, and then we propose some solution to that problem. We test the solution and find errors in it and eliminate those errors, and then end up with improved knowledge and some new problems. So in science, what we do is to identify a problem. So that may be a disagreement between observations and predictions from theory. We then propose a hypothesis to solve that problem, and we test the hypothesis. We don't collect evidence for it. We're not engaging in sort of conspiracy theory activities here. You could find evidence for any theory, probably, but what we're trying to do is to test the hypothesis and thereby generate new knowledge and a new problem. So scientific knowledge is a body of corroborated theory. It's not a body of laws that are proved by accumulating evidence. And Popper's important insight was that falsification is logically different from proof. And there's this famous example that's usually trotted out when Popper is discussed, and it's the theory that all swans are white. So the observation of a single non-white swan, just black swan for a case of simplicity, falsifies the theory, but any number of white swans can't prove the theory. There'd be many, many other theories that would agree with the observations that if we just observe white swans, what we need to do to test that theory is to search for the black swans, not just count the white swans. So does this have any relevance for risk assessment? Well, yes, I think it does. We could think of acceptable effects of the GM crops as white swans and unacceptable effects or harm of the GM crops as the black swans. So clearly what we can't do is to prove that all the swans are white, i.e. we can't prove safety of the crop. And equally, we can't falsify the hypothesis that somewhere or other, at some time, there will be a black swan. So we can't prove there's no harm, in other words, which would be equivalent to proving safety. But what we can do is to test and corroborate the hypothesis that all swans are white. In other words, that there will be no harmful effects from the use of the GM crop. So a risk assessment is a collection of tests of hypotheses of no harm, and you could regard safety as a collection of well-corroborated hypotheses of no harm. We can't prove safety, but we can test hypotheses of no harm. So laying it out in terms of this pathway, what we do is to identify what's harmful, and usually that we go to law or some policy for that. Then we develop hypotheses that no harm will occur from what we're proposing to do, in this case cultivate the GM crop. We then test those hypotheses, and I'll give you some examples of hypotheses in a minute. And by testing those hypotheses, we increase our knowledge of risk, and that allows us to make decisions, which may be to carry on testing some different hypotheses, or to make a decision about whether to permit release of the GM crop. And formulation of the hypotheses that we test in the risk assessment comes under this area of problem formulation. So we're determining what's harmful and how harm may arise and which hypotheses we will test. And then once we have the hypotheses, we can test them and develop our knowledge of risk, and this is risk characterization. And I think there's often a temptation to dive in to data collection before we've sorted out what's harmful and how harm may occur. So it's very important to set the problem first before rushing out collecting data. So why go to all this trouble of laying this out? Well, I think thinking about risk assessments as tests of hypotheses of no harm makes the acquisition of data much more effective. We avoid accumulating lots of data that may be irrelevant because we're trying to prove safety by inductive logic rather than test hypotheses using deductive logic. In other words, what we should be doing in a risk assessment is looking for black swans, not just collecting white swans. And the reasons for this, I think, one of the reasons is that collecting, analysing and evaluating the data that are unnecessary for risk assessment may delay the introduction of environmentally beneficial products. In fact, it may prevent their development altogether because the production of the data is so costly. So we should always remember that producing data is not free from risk, because you may be delaying something that's environmentally beneficial and thereby increasing risk. And if you look at the amount of data that we have to submit to various regulatory authorities, I think it's worth asking the question about whether we really are testing hypotheses. Are we really searching for black swans, or are we just collecting white swans? In other words, are we accumulating data which we knew the answer to already? So to be effective, risk assessment must begin with a definition of harm, and that definition is inevitably subjective. We can't work it out by doing studies, and it's not the same as the all possible effects of the GM crop. So we've got these two bubbles here. One is all the things that we regard as harmful to the environment, and all the plausible effects of growing the GM crop. And where those intersect, these are the potential harms from growing the GM crop, and these are the risk hypotheses predict that these effects will not occur. Now, I think often environmental fate data are presented like this, that the presence of the protein in a crop during cultivation, or its presence in a target pest, that's fine, but its presence in soil or in water, volunteer populations and feral populations of the crop wild hybrids, and the presence of the protein in non-target organisms all tend to be presented as harmful. But really, the presence of the protein is not harmful. To be harmful, it must have an adverse effect on something that we value. And usually the thing that we look at is reductions in population sizes of animals via toxicity of the protein, although there are other harms that will be looked at increasingly. I think things like soil quality as crops that produce industrial enzymes are introduced. But I'm just going to look at population reduction in this talk. So we have reduction in population size, reduction in population size of target pests, that should be fine, but perhaps all non-target organisms, the reduction in population size of those would be regarded as harmful. But not all non-target organisms are desirable. There may be some pests that are not actually the target of what we're doing, and under this definition, they would be regarded as desirable, and I don't think that's really very useful. What we really should be trying to do is to identify species that that are desirable to us, and it would be reduction in the population size of those species that we regard as harmful. And that would be the rational way to do it, but unfortunately it's quite hard to define what a desirable species is. There may be some guidance, perhaps in endangered species legislation, for example, but what about species that provide ecosystem services and biodiversity for its own sake? How do we define what the desirable species are? It's quite a hard problem. So what we tend to do is to divide species into pest species and non-pest species, and regard the reduction in the population size of any non-pest species as harmful. So harm is the reduction in population size of a non-pest species, and environmental fate data are used to test the hypothesis of no reduction in the population sizes of those species. So really the reason for going through that is that we have to decide what the harm is before we can engage in risk assessment activity that's going to be worthwhile. So we're erecting some hypotheses, and I just want to talk a little bit about the difference between accuracy and precision in scientific research and risk assessment, because I think this helps to clarify the kinds of data that we need. Now in science, I think we seek both accuracy and precision. It's easy to make statements that are likely to be accurate. So it'll rain somewhere in Europe next month, that's likely to be accurate, but it's so imprecise that it's really boring. But a hypothesis, say, that it will rain in Madrid but not in London at 3 p.m. tomorrow, that's less likely to be accurate, but for that reason it's much more interesting. Now in risk assessment, what the hypotheses are seeking to do is to help make decisions. They're not seeking to be interesting necessarily. In fact, sometimes the more boring the better. So an accurate prediction that it would rain somewhere in Europe next month may be sufficient to make a decision, and if it is, then development and testing of hypotheses of precisely where and when it will rain will be unnecessary. And I think if we substitute protein for rain in those statements, we can sort of see that we may not need to characterise specifically where the protein is to make decisions. So a very simple hypothesis for testing may be that there are no non-pest species will be exposed to the protein during or after cultivation of the crop. And we could bring various pieces of data to bear on that hypothesis. Developmental expression study, so where in the plant is the protein produced and how much of the protein is there. Data on the biology of the crop, how far it pollen disperses, what its pests are, what the predators and parasitoids of those pests are, that kind of thing. Its persistence in the field, so volunteer weeds, the spread of the crop outside the field, feral populations, gene flow to other species, and the movement of protein into soil and water. And the specific hypotheses that we may want to test, perhaps we're looking at the persistence and spread of the crop. So if one was doing scientific research, one may want to make precise predictions of the numbers of GM crops, but if you're doing risk assessment, a simple hypothesis like that crop Y is no more invasive than crop X may be sufficient. Similarly, hypotheses about gene flow, if one's doing research, then we may be wanting to predict the precise numbers of GM hybrids. But for a risk assessment, one may need to do is to test the hypothesis that crop A doesn't hybridise with crop B. And hypotheses about the fate of the protein in soil and water. If one's doing research, then making precise predictions about concentrations of the protein may be useful. For environmental risk assessment, all we may need to know is that the protein is inherently degradable. Now, it's likely that some non-pest species will be exposed, therefore we'll have to develop hypotheses about the potential adverse effects of exposure. And again, if one's doing research, one may want to make precise predictions of how toxic the protein is and how much of the protein organisms we're exposed to. But for risk assessment, all one may need to do is just simply test the hypothesis that the no observable adverse effect concentration is greater than 10 times the average exposure to the protein. And one could test for that by doing studies of the adverse effects in the laboratory on representative species that at least 10 times the average concentration of the protein in the relevant crop tissue. So precise characterization of the exposure pathways may not be necessary for risk assessment. So to wind up, I think what we need to do for environmental risk assessment is first we need to define the harm, and that's subjective and we can't determine it scientifically. It's going to be derived from law or some other policy instrument. We then need to develop clear hypotheses of no harm, and I think the way to do that most effectively is to avoid complicated hypotheses that make precise predictions, unless decisions depend on exact quantification of an effect. So simple hypotheses that make semi-quantitative predictions, so no more than something, no less than something, may be more helpful. So simple hypotheses like there will be no exposure of non-pest species, or for all non-pest species, the no observable adverse effect concentration is greater than 10 times the expected environmental concentration, maybe all we need to do. We don't actually need to know what the no observable adverse effect concentration is, or precisely what the EEC is, as long as we're confident that that ratio is greater than 10. So the precise characterization of the environmental fate of the protein may be unnecessary for testing risk hypotheses. Now that doesn't mean that making precise predictions is not useful, because it may be that they're answering useful research questions. And this isn't my area of expertise, but these are questions that come to mind to me to ask how does precise characterization of the environmental fate of a protein further scientific knowledge? Does production of transgenic proteins in GM crops provide opportunities to test existing hypotheses more rigorously? Or do we need to develop new theory to predict the behaviour of these transgenic proteins? And I think if we don't, then environmental fate studies risk becoming part of a kind of natural history of GM crops. It's descriptive rather than analytical and synthetic. And that may not be harm in itself, but I think there's kind of a danger of environmental fate work becoming almost a freak show. You know, we're obsessed with finding the protein further from the source, or it's longer in the soil, or you know, higher up the trophic levels. But to be interesting, these observations should test the theory that those events are not possible. I remember in Britain in the 1990s, we spent hundreds of thousands of pounds looking at the dispersal of oilseed rape pollen and how far away from a source population could cross-fertilisation still occur. Now, there was no theory that said that there shouldn't be fertilisation over a certain distance, and there wasn't anything that said that hybrids, that cross fertilisation over a certain distance is harmful. So really there was no context for these observations, but they were presented very sensationally, you know, oh no, we found cross fertilisation at 40 miles when previously it was only 20 miles. Now, because those observations were not testing any hypothesis, that there was really no context for interpreting them. And the problem is that presentation of those data in a sensationalist way could cause concern and outrage. So really the final point is that in order to set these results in context, we need some hypothesis. Now that may be a risk hypothesis of no harm, or it is some scientific hypothesis that the protein shouldn't occur where we're looking. So I think we need to present our results very carefully in order to not engender unnecessary concern and outrage. So thank you for your time.
We have time for questions, if anyone has questions.
Alan, I have a question for you. Could you talk a little bit more about the definitions of pest versus non-pest and kind of non-target organisms and how that has all proceeded? I mean, how did we end up using the term NTO versus otherwise?
So the question is, how have we reached our definition of non-target organism? I'm not sure. It's a term that's been around for a long time without it rigorously being defined. I think people see effects on pest species that are not the intended target, and I think we've come to the conclusion that that isn't harmful. So the strict definition of a non-target organism being anything that isn't the target of your crop, it doesn't really hold up for risk assessment. On the other hand, it's difficult to define exactly what it is we want to protect. Endangered species legislation helps in some cases, but really where we've got to is that if it's not a pest, then we should treat a reduction in its population size as something of concern. Now, I don't know whether there's anyone from regulatory agencies who could help here. I mean, this is just something that we work with when we're doing our risk assessments in order just to set up some testable hypotheses rather than, you know, just sort of shooting in the dark for a target that we can't see. So it is a difficult problem, but it hasn't caused a lot of problems so far because of the specificity of the target range of the protein. But I think if we start introducing more broad spectrum proteins, then we're going to need to define what it is we want to protect much more closely.